From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As he was leaving the White House this morning, President Trump had a lot to say about Russia and Special Counsel Robert Mueller, a day after Mueller's first public comments on his Russia investigation. The president walked back a tweet from this morning that said that Russia helped him get elected. He called Special Counsel Robert Mueller a conflicted never-Trumper. And he insisted that Mueller yesterday absolved him, the president, of any impeachable crimes.
He said, essentially, you're innocent. I'm innocent of all charges. And you know the thing that nobody brings up? There was no crime.
In fact, Mueller said he specifically did not say that the president did not commit a crime. But that aside, there is a growing number of Democrats now calling for impeachment, and one of them is California Democrat Jackie Speier, who joins us. Congresswoman, you were in favor of impeachment before Mueller's comments. What case are you making to Democrats who aren't there yet?
It is a personal decision with each member. There's no question about that. I think that many members are primed to join in an effort to want to initiate the impeachment process. They're waiting for a sign from the speaker, I believe. And then there are about 40 members who are in districts that were won by Trump that I think see themselves in a perilous position. Now, having said all of that, what Robert Mueller said yesterday was so consequential. It was in his voice. It wasn't, you know, written on paper. It was so clear that he said if we had confidence the president didn't commit a crime, we would have said so.
So why is the speaker and other members of the leadership in your party not where you are on this issue? She has made the case, not directly, but it sounds like her thought is it would actually be politically helpful to the president, or an impeachment proceeding wouldn't go anywhere because it would have to get to the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, and they're not going to turn on the president.
Well, I think she's looking at the political reality that if we shed all the blood in the House by going through the process and then the Senate under Mitch McConnell stonewalls, as he is doing with every piece of legislation that the House has passed, and there have been over 100 bills that have been passed by the House, sent to the Senate, and Mitch McConnell has made it very clear he's not going to take any of them up. So the likelihood of him taking up an impeachment action in the House where, you know, blood is actually going to be shed is very remote. Now, having said all that, our responsibility is to the Constitution, is to protecting this democracy. This is a lawless man, and the president is not above the law. We keep saying that over and over again. Well, if he's not above the law, why aren't we taking the steps we should be taking?
Well, so who do you think is going to win this battle in your party? People like you or people like Speaker Pelosi?
Well, my hope is that we will do what is necessary to inform the American public about what's in the 400 pages. To hear a constituent of Congressman Amash say, well, I listen to conservative radio and TV, and I never heard any of these things about what the president has done, is truly frightening, because we are living in our own echo chambers. And the result is, you know, truth does not necessarily rise to the surface. So Justin Amash and others like him who are willing to stand up are true American heroes.
Well, let me ask you one more thing, because this is just one part of the story, the question of holding the president accountable. But at the same time, what Mueller did say yesterday is that he is very concerned about Russian election interference, which may be ongoing right now as we speak going into 2020. Is anything going to be done to protect the nation from that?
That is one of my greatest fears. I have held briefings in the House with expert hackers that have told us repeatedly that these machines are very hackable, that there is no way of really being able to prove that the Russians did not get into these voting machines. And the use of the internet to forward data should be stopped. I think we should return to paper ballots and comprehensive audits after the fact. all of which could take place certainly for the presidential election. We can compel states to use paper ballots for federal elections.
Well, and on that, you and President Trump agree, because he said he wanted good old-fashioned paper ballots just this morning. We'll have to leave it there, though. Jackie Speier, Democrat, who represents California's 14th district in the House, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He joins us regularly to put the news through an historical lens. And today we want to do that with special counsel Robert Mueller. Julian, we wanted to ask you yesterday and we want to ask you even more today. Do you think Mueller could have been more direct in his statement? Because we have the president today saying that Mueller said he was innocent and that there was no crime. Mueller specifically said, if we thought there was no crime, we would have said so. We couldn't. Is there a little bit too much double negative in there?
No, I think he was being very clear with what the report said and what he felt comfortable sending to Congress. It wasn't unclear that, you know, he didn't feel comfortable saying that no crimes had been committed. And that's a pretty big statement to say. And so he could have said it more positively. I don't think the president's response today would have been any different.
Right. There's possibly that. But what about Attorney General Barr's take on the report? We know that Mueller wrote him a letter saying, I disagree with your characterization of what I said. I mean, Barr was asked, was Mueller making any decisions, you know, with his hands tied by DOJ rules? I'm paraphrasing here. And Barr said no. Mueller very specifically said that he did feel, and again, I'm paraphrasing, his hands were tied by DOJ rules, that he couldn't indict a sitting president, implying that it was Congress's job to take a look at this. Should he have been more direct in speaking to the public yesterday and saying, I feel I was, you know, mischaracterized?
Well, that's a tough call. He still does work for the attorney general. That's the rules of how we now conduct these investigations. He's not an independent prosecutor. He did make it pretty clear with his statement that what Attorney General Barr said doesn't actually match what he was saying in the report. And at best, he said, I can't remember the term, that his intentions might have been good. But I think he was pretty clear that those were misstatements at best. And you know, Mueller, what makes him appealing is that he does follow the rules. He does follow process. And so to expect him to go beyond that probably just doesn't fit who he is in terms of his character.
Well, explain, you know, why he didn't. And you feel, you know, people are saying he's a public servant and he displayed that admirably. But people are asking, well, wait a second. When Ken Starr investigated then President Clinton, his report included impeachable offenses. Mueller's report had incidents that might have been obstruction. You know, what's the difference, and why was it different?
One big difference is Kenneth Starr was operating under a law set up in 1978 after Watergate that created an office of an independent counsel, and that gave the prosecutor wide discretion in terms of the kind of report that they produced and the kinds of recommendations that they made. Those were abandoned, for better or worse. And so a special prosecutor today can't say the same kinds of things. They're more like what we had in Watergate, where Leon Jaworski had to give a roadmap to Congress about what he had found and suggest that Congress then needs to investigate further. That's what Mueller did. And I think the real question is why Congress won't take him up on this report.
Yeah, won't take him up, you said.
So far, won't.
Well, but talk about that. I mean, what do you think Democrats should do in this moment, given what Mueller seems to be asking them to do?
I think the report from Mueller laid out a pretty powerful case of a president misusing or abusing his power. And the House has a process, an impeachment process, that they can employ at this point, which would start with investigation and hearings, very serious ones and centralized ones. It's hard to see why the House wouldn't do that other than politics. Even Speaker Pelosi has said very clearly there's a lot of evidence for impeachment here. It's simply about what's the best sense of what the party needs to do for 220 and in terms of protecting its majority.
Because the thinking is that after Republicans tried to remove Bill Clinton from office, he was impeached, but he was not removed from office. Impeaching is just the charge And then the trial goes to the Senate. But then the Republicans paid for it at the ballot box.
Well, they did, although they kept the majority in 1998, and then they went on to win the presidency. So it's a messy comparison, and I think there's an argument to be made. Democrats are trapped in that moment, and it doesn't necessarily fit both the substance of the charges today or how the politics would play out.
I'm going to do something unfair. 30 seconds. How will Mueller go down in history?
I think a good public servant who produced a good report but didn't necessarily know how to translate that report for a very polarized public.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. We will take this up again, I'm sure. Julian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And we love your thoughts. Do you think you were reading too many tea leaves after Mueller's statement? Was it clear to you? Thoughts welcome, hereandnow.org.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
That is the sound of a physical therapy session at the University of Louisville, designed specifically for people with spinal cord injuries. Kent Stevenson is on a treadmill working to put one foot in front of the other as a team of trainers helps guide his legs. There's a harness holding him upright, and he needs help, but Stevenson is, in a sense, walking again, thanks to new research from the Kentucky Spinal Cord Injury Research Center. The fact that he's making movements is amazing, because just 10 years ago, Stevenson was in an accident that changed his life forever.
I was out practicing on a track, and going off the face of a jump, my motor locked up, and I tried to jump away from the bike, didn't work for me, landed and kind of just cartwheeled somersaults and everything, and dust settled, and I pretty much knew instantly that I couldn't move my legs, and then waited, and ambulance got there, and then they rolled me over, heard a bunch of pops and everything, and then it really set in once I got out at the hospital, the care flight, and I saw the reflection of my body, and I could see that I still had my knee braces and stuff on, and I couldn't feel it, and that's when it set in for me that this was serious, you know, that I really had done something.
Stevenson came to Louisville from Texas to be part of an experimental treatment for spinal cord injuries that has helped him regain some motion, even if he'll never make a full recovery. The woman behind this research is Dr. Susan Harkema. In her office in Louisville, she says spinal cord injuries affect a lot more than a person's voluntary movements. So she's working for incremental victories over paralysis that can mean major improvements for a patient's quality of life.
So somebody's paralyzed and literally almost everything's taken away from them. Mm-hmm. You think about it as they can't walk again. That's just the tip of the iceberg. They lose the ability to breathe. They lose, not completely, obviously, but they
makes it much more difficult.
They
for
don't
them to breathe
as well. Mm-hmm. Their heart doesn't function as well. They can't eat as well. They lose bowel, bladder, sexual function. They can't regulate their temperature. Everything does not function like it did before.
Harkema's lab is pioneering the use of something called an epidural stimulator, a surgical implant that sends a continuous electrical current to the nervous system. It's sometimes used to treat pain, but when Dr. Harkema and her colleagues used the device to stimulate the lower portions of the spinal cord, they found it could help some patients with spinal cord injuries regain voluntary motion in their lower bodies without actually repairing the neurological gap created by the spinal cord injury itself.
After a spinal cord injury, as devastating as that is, mm-hmm. it's only where the bone is broken that the neurons die. And that's thousands of neurons. But there's millions more below the injury that are still alive and healthy and under the right conditions can function. And above the injury, there's millions of neurons that are alive and healthy. And we understand that. We know above the injury they're alive and healthy. What we haven't thought about is below the injury they are too. And we've never targeted those for recovery. That's what we do here. We're understanding how they function below the injury. And then how can we get the ones above to communicate below?
So just to use an example or to liken it to a physical object, let's say it's an electrical cord. What you're saying is that the part of the electrical cord that's going into the socket, that part works. The part that's going into the device works. There's just a gap, and you're trying to figure out how to make everything else work, even though that one part is completely broken.
Well, yes, we thought it was, but it must not be. So that's the thing. So where it started was in animals, every species, and most importantly in a mammal, adult mammal, it was known that if you completely transected the spinal cord, you could get a cat, for example, to relearn how to get their hind limbs to step again. Okay, if that's true in an adult mammal, then if we took a clinically complete human being and used the same strategy, we could get them to relearn to walk, theoretically. So we took those people by every diagnosis, every clinical and neurophysiological diagnosis to be clinically complete. So that means, like you're saying, is that, okay, the wire is completely cut.
Mm-hmm.
But what we found was it wasn't completely cut.
That discovery means it might be possible to restore some motion and physiological functions once thought to be lost forever.
We're not doing anything with the injury. We're just working with those millions of neurons that are still alive and viable. They haven't been injured. That's the circuitry we're working with.
So okay. What kind of success have you had?
So we've had varied success, and I want to point one other thing out. Mm-hmm. We've had successes not just using the epidural stimulator, but understanding how the circuitry works. So I just want to put – that's the important thing to understand too. And I think what's important to know is that we've had successes with people who have been injured for many years, but the successes are varied. And nobody is back to where they were before their injury. But we've had people who couldn't move their legs who can now move their legs. People who could not stand who can now stand. Hmm. People who could not take steps who can now take steps. People who blood pressures were so low that they would pass out 4 or 5 times a day who now can sit up, are more alert, and can talk to their family members who couldn't do a load of laundry because they were passing out who now can do that and can cook. Person who used to be a singer who couldn't sing a note and now, as she says, sings but mostly still in the shower. Okay, so this is what I'm saying is we call it incremental victories over paralysis, getting closer and closer back to normal.
So what does getting closer and closer to normal mean for Kent Stevenson, who we heard earlier during his physical therapy session?
I got all my voluntary movements back and my independent standing is coming back. I'm looking forward to getting off a little medication for my bladder, and so I'm looking forward to getting rid of that.
How long do you think you'll continue to come here?
I'll come till they kick me out. It's awesome. I mean, it's just the positive atmosphere and just being able to do things that you were told you'd never be able to do. I mean, it's awesome. I mean, really knowing people who haven't been able to go through this and see how their life is. I mean, it's given me the. I mean, it's just. It kind of brings your body back to life from how it is when you get hurt. Everything just kind of cuts off and you're a newborn baby and you really can't tap back into a lot of stuff. But with this, it's given me the ability to tap back into what was cut off, and just the overall health benefits I've seen are just tremendous. Because, I mean, the only medication I take is that one bladder thing, and it's just for spasms, which I can see getting off of that because I can feel all this coming back, like just coming back around, coming back alive, it feels like.
Stevenson is one of just 21 people who have received the epidural stimulator treatment for a spinal cord injury so far. Dr. Harkema cautions that it is not suitable for everybody with a spinal cord injury, and there are always risks with surgery, especially for people whose immune systems might be compromised by a spinal cord injury. But the researchers hope FDA approval will allow medical device manufacturers to expand the reach of this new treatment.
by activating the neuromuscular system below the level of injury, taking advantage of this whole capacity, all these systems, motor, bowel, bladder, sexual function, cardiovascular system, respiratory, all could be better for people who are initially injured and even those that have been injured for many years. The challenge is access, is getting the information to clinicians, to get the technology available so people have access to it, getting the rehabilitation centers to be able to provide it.
How soon will that happen? How soon will this be widely available around the country?
Well, it's difficult because it's not the scientists that make those decisions. It's the other stakeholders. It's the healthcare providers, right? It's the healthcare system that we have. It's insurance companies. It's legislators. It's all those things, right? So sometimes I say the science is the easy part, right? It's all these other things that are more difficult. So all the stakeholders have to come together in order to get the delivery there. And there's still discoveries to be made. There's still more trials to be done. There's still a lot of work to be done.
Harkema's work has received funding from the National Institutes of Health and numerous other groups, including the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, the Craig H. Nielsen Foundation, and the Helmsley Charitable Trust. Funding that has allowed her to continue a focus on helping people with spinal cord injuries for 25 years. What made you decide to spend so much of your time working on this issue?
Well, first of all, like, I'm just a hardcore scientist at heart. I love discovering new things. But I'm going to say it was the first person I worked with spinal cord injury, who, I'll tell you, the first experiment I did was not that successful. And that person took me out for lunch, and I was like, what, are you crazy? And he said, thank you for trying. And, you know, from that, certainly that moment on, I certainly was hooked. I mean, this is an incredible group of people who you cannot even imagine how hard every minute of every day is, and their strength and courage and just incredible motivation that they have just to get through the day. That in itself is inspiring. And so, you know, it's easy. It's easy to be dedicated.
Mitch McConnell has become a champion for conservatives. But back in the day, he once got support from groups like labor unions.
I mark it down as one of the worst things I've ever done in my life.
So you thought about it over the years?
Oh, I still think about it. Every time I see his face...
Mitch McConnell, a new series from Embedded. Subscribe now.
And right now, you may be wearing a wearable device. I've got a Fitbit on. Shout out to the Here and Now team that came in 16 out of 200 teams in the Boston University Step Challenge. But did you know there are now brain wearables? They claim to reduce stress, help you sleep, and medical professionals are saying be careful about those claims. Megan Thielking covers mental health for our partners at STAT. Megan, welcome.
Hi, great to be here.
So are these what we think they are? They sound like something that you put on your head?
Yeah, some of them look sort of like over-the-ear headphones or their little stick-on devices. Some of them give little electrical zaps to the brain, and some of them are used to monitor brain activity.
They're EEGs that monitor electrical activity, and the others, as you say, give a little zap, maybe like... Well, sometimes there's dog training collars, which we're not recommending, but something that like that kind of a zap?
Yeah, it's just electrical pulses that are aimed at specific parts of the brain.
Okay, and what are the claims?
So I spoke to some researchers who ran a study looking at the claims of 41 of these direct-to-consumer brain wearables, and they found that claims about wellness or personal enhancement of some kind, like that a device could ease stress or make you concentrate better, were the most common. But 9 of the devices that they looked at actually made claims about health conditions, which included PTSD, depression, chronic pain, a whole range of stuff.
Well, it sounds as if some are making claims about things like dementia. Here's an example you used in your piece. The makers of Bellaby's headset said on their Indiegogo page, 82-year-old lady started last week after using Bellaby's headset for only 3 weeks, once again recognizing her family members. as if she had some form of dementia beforehand. Now, you write something that I think is so interesting. You write that under federal law, companies can't claim that a product can treat, prevent, or cure a disease unless they have the evidence to back that up. I looked at that and said, really? Because it seems like you see them doing that all the time. If you were claiming that you could, you know, have someone with Alzheimer's or dementia suddenly recognize their family members, that would be a big deal.
Yeah, so what some experts told me is that some companies are sort of, one expert described it to me as like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge marketing approach. So it's not directly claiming that they can treat or prevent a disease, but they might make an association with a specific condition. People with insomnia say they feel less stressed out when they use this device. And so some of the experts I spoke with said, you know, there's sort of a cavalier approach to the marketing of some of these devices, and that's causing some concern.
Yeah, you talked to neurologists, neuroethics people. What did they say?
They said really that they'd like to see brain wearable companies step up and start taking more responsibility over the claims they're making. And they think there's a lot of room for improvement in that area. They could tell customers not to use their products in place of traditional medical care. That was a big concern I heard, was that people might be using these devices instead of seeking medical interventions that they might need. They should be making consumers aware that there isn't long-term safety data on a lot of these brain stimulation devices, and be clear with people about the real benefits that have been studied and sort of the aspirational benefits that they hope are happening for people.
Real quick, Megan, why aren't these more regulated?
A lot of them are seen as lifestyle devices, so they're not necessarily something that would be regulated. Where they enter into potential regulation is around the marketing claims that are being made. But because they're not technically treating a medical condition, they're not something that would be regulated by the FDA.
So buyer beware. Megan Thielking, who covers mental health for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Megan, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
President Trump says he was not informed about a request the White House reportedly made to have the Navy block the name of the USS John S. McCain during Trump's visit to Japan over the weekend. It's named after three generations of McCains who have served in the military, including the late senator from Arizona, with whom Trump had a long public feud. Let's bring in Washington Post national security reporter Dan Lamoth, who's been on this story. Dan, the Wall Street Journal first reported that a U.S. Indo-Pacific Command official wrote an email to Navy and Air Force officials ahead of the president's visit that said, in part, USS John McCain needs to be out of sight, and that the Navy used first a tarp and then a barge to block the ship's name from view. What exactly did the White House ask the Navy to do with this ship, and what actually happened?
The specifics, as I understand them, are that there was indeed an email sent to military officials out in the Pacific, and that the White House did indeed make a request to keep the McCain basically as out of sight as possible during this visit. It appears that that was initially complied with. There was a tarp up on Friday, and when Navy officials higher up got wind of what was happening, they reversed course and said, take that down. So by the time the president arrived there later in the weekend, during the Memorial Day weekend, everything was back to normal.
Okay. And how unusual would that be to have the name of an American ship blocked for a presidential visit?
Highly unusual. And in this case particular, you're talking a vessel that recently overcame a tragedy where you had numerous sailors killed. That vessel is named after three generations of McCains, all of which served in the Navy for years. Obviously, Senator McCain as a pilot who ultimately was taken prisoner in Vietnam, and then his father and grandfather were admirals. So, I mean, this is something that usually you would honor, not hide.
And in fact, you and your colleagues report that crew members of the McCain were not invited to Trump's visit, which occurred on another ship, the USS Wasp.
Sure. The piece that we're trying to get clarity on there, there's no way you necessarily would have been able to fit everyone that served on that base for that particular presidential visit. So they chose to hold the event on the Wasp, which is an amphibious ship that typically has maybe upwards of 1,000 people that live on it when it's deployed. But they chose to leave the McCain and one other vessel out. So my question is, why was the McCain the one you left out? And if there's a good reason for that, we haven't heard it yet.
Now, you and your colleagues report that when senior Navy officials grasped what was happening, they had Navy personnel take down the tarp before the visit. So was there some friction between Navy officials and the White House here?
We're trying to get a sense for exactly how high up this went in the Navy in terms of wanting to sort of correct or change the course that they were on, and whether or not there was friction with the White House or whether or not they simply said, hey, this is a bad idea, and just kind of made the decision, on their own on the ground.
Let's listen to what President Trump said about it this morning, because he was asked about it before he departed for Colorado. Here he is.
To me, John McCain, I wasn't a fan, but I would never do a thing like that. Now, somebody did it because they thought I didn't like him, okay? And they were well-meaning, I will say. I didn't know anything about it. I would never have done that.
So he says he didn't know anything about it, but that whoever did it was well-meaning, which would mean that they were making him happy because he's made very clear that he's not a fan of John McCain. What do you make of how he's responded to this, saying he didn't know anything about it?
I kind of wonder if that's an extremely honest answer. He may have been left out of the loop, but is openly acknowledging now that he has become aware of this. Clearly he has no problems with somebody trying to do this based on what he said, which I think is, whether or not that's appropriate is a whole separate issue.
Did you get any better sense? And, we're all trying to make sense of some of the things that are going on in Washington, but do you get any better sense of why Trump is so fixated on John McCain still? He's now been deceased for some time.
I wish we knew. John McCain was no fan of the president and regularly was a critic of him. I think he was able to be a critic of him from a different lane, where he wasn't a Democrat. So, there's a contingent of Republicans who obviously hold Senator McCain in very high regard and always will. So I feel like there's largely frustration there and probably an understanding that there are McCain, disciples, if you will, who simply will never accept the president acting in the manner he does.
That's Washington Post national security reporter Dan Lamothe. We'll link you to more of his reporting on this at hereandnow.org. Dan, thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Well, have you heard of the hashtag My Last Shot campaign? People like Audrey Porter are taking part. She's a high school student from a Seattle suburb. And she says if she's ever shot and killed, she wants newspapers to publish photographs of her dead body. David Hyde from member station KUOW reports.
In many ways, Audrey Porter is a typical high school student.
I'm a junior at Kendi Catholic down in Burien, super close to the airport.
But Porter's also an early member of the student-led My Last Shot campaign.
Jefferson County 911.
Yes, I'm a teacher calling back high school. There is a student here with a gun. He has shot out a window.
It was started by students at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, nearly 20 years after the worst high school shooting at that point in U.S. history left 13 dead.
Okay, has anybody been injured, ma'am?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And the school is in a panic, and I'm in the library.
To participate in My Last Shot, students attach a sticker to the back of their ID that says,
in the event that I die from gun violence, please publicize the photo of my death. Hashtag My Last Shot, signed Audrey Porter.
The campaign is being spread over social media, mostly Snapchat and Instagram, Porter said. My Last Shot was inspired by the story of Emmett Till, the 14-year-old African-American boy who was lynched in Mississippi in 1955 after being accused of offending a white woman. A photo of him taken in his casket was published in newspapers across the United States, the equivalent of going viral for that time period.
And it really brought the reality of racism and the reality of segregation to the rest of the country.
Porter and other participants want the press to publish graphic photographs of gun violence to provoke action to pass gun safety legislation. But would the media ever do it? We put that question to Elizabeth Jensen, NPR's public editor.
NPR does not show graphic images of the moment of death, of someone's death.
Jensen said one concern is for the victims' families. But it's not entirely clear what NPR would do in the case of a student with a My Last Shot sticker on their ID. Jensen said that call would be made at the time. Sarah Centillas is an author who writes about what images of the dead the press decides to show and which ones it leaves out. And she thinks the students behind the My Last Shot campaign have a point.
I think it's also a way for them to take agency at a time when they feel helpless. You know, they're forced to go to school and the adults charged with taking care of them can't guarantee their safety. So I read the My Last Shot as a kind of way to claim agency and also almost a threat. If you can't do a better job at protecting us, then you're going to have to see our bodies if we're killed.
Cheyenne Coe thinks the press should not publish images of the dead. She was a ninth grader at Marysville-Pilchuck High School back in 2014 when the worst school shooting in Washington state history occurred.
I had known Zoe since I was probably 3 years old, grew up next door to her.
Five people ended up dead, including her childhood friend, Zoe Galasso. Co says at the time, the press coverage was just too much.
Unless you went pretty much in the middle of the night, you couldn't go without the press being there and wanting to talk to you and wanting to ask you questions.
And she spent several years dealing with nightmares and flashbacks. So Co thinks the media should think carefully before publishing photos of the dead.
I'm really happy that I didn't see them at that point. I feel like I would have had a very difficult time finding ways to move on.
Even now, just seeing another student reach into a bag for a pencil can take her back to that day. For Here and Now, I'm David Hyde in Seattle.
The NBA Finals tip off tonight, the first time ever on Canadian soil. Well, the Toronto Raptors may have home court advantage, but they face the Golden State Warriors, who've won the last two titles. And man, did you watch that overtime in hockey last night? Or see that poor little girl get hit by that foul ball in baseball? Lots going on. Let's bring in Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, the NBA, you've said that the fact that the Warriors star Kevin Durant is out with an injury, that won't matter. You still think that?
Well, I think it will matter. I do think the Warriors are the better team, and Las Vegas agrees with me, and that is the order of operations. Las Vegas sees what I'm thinking, and then they make their decisions. But so the Warriors are big favorites. Las Vegas essentially says they have about a 75% chance of winning. You would have to be crazy not to think one of the five best players in the world can't help any team. And they are more intimidating. They are statistically better. However, just in terms of the joyousness of play, it does seem a Durantless Warriors creates a flow where Steph Curry can create with the ball, where Draymond Green can just dash down the middle of the lane and maybe shoot or maybe pass. And they're statistically, in terms of wins and losses, actually better without Durant. But I would think that anyone who was objectively looking at it would say Durant on the team, they're more likely to win. Even without Durant, they're probably still likely to win. But without Durant, it will be a more fun team to watch.
Mike, what do you make of the fact that there's a map that's being circulated by a sports gambling website that seems to reflect some Warriors fatigue? It shows that all but three states in this country, those being California, Nevada, and Hawaii, want Toronto to win the series.
Okay, first of all, I will say that I understand Warriors' fatigue with Durant. Even without Durant, you know, when one team is good for so long, other teams want a chance. And with Durant, they have essentially a cheat code. They're unstoppable. That's not fun. But I have huge methodological problems with how they made that map. What they did was they looked at how many people tweeted the hashtag We the North and how many people tweeted the hashtag Dubs Nation. And the deal with We the North, I think, is what a political scientist or a psychologist would call salience. Every Canadian in the United States, if they're living in any state, loves the fact that a Canadian team is in the finals, so they tweet We the North, whereas just a casual fan who might like the Warriors better than the Raptors would tweet or not tweet Dub Nation. Also, the Warriors series was ending in four. There wasn't a whole lot of opportunity to tweet Dub Nation. I think it's, let's just say that whatever the online gambling site who made that, they're not going down along with like Gallup in the pupil.
Mike, we should talk about hockey.
Yes.
Because there was a big game last night there in the Stanley Cup Final. This is the first time St. Louis has ever won a game in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Yeah.
They beat the Boston Bruins in overtime to tie the series at one win apiece. I know, Robin, that there were people in St. Louis who had packed the stadium there where the game was not happening,
exactly,
going, honk, 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 let's go Blues. But Mike, how do you see the series going from here now, one apiece?
Yeah, and we should say the Blues' history in the Stanley Cup is fascinating because for the first 3 years of their existence, they made the finals and were swept every year because they were an expansion team, and the NFL had this kind of insane structure where there was one league with one conference with just expansion teams. So, you know, wait about 50 years and then they finally get their chance to win. I still think that the Bruins have the advantage because I think that Tuukka Rask is an excellent goalie.
He
is great. And up and down the roster, the Bruins, even though the Blues are a great team and maybe on a roll from this, I think the Bruins still have the slight advantage.
Okay, we just got to mention there was that big hit in that game last night. The Blues player Oscar Sundquist smashing the Bruins' Matt Grzelcyk's head against the glass. Penalty called against the Blues player. You know, he might be suspended. We don't have, you know, Grzelcyk is, you know, on the concussion list. He's not traveling. So that, you know, just a reminder that game can be dangerous. But another reminder, I mean, it was an odd night, Mike, because there was that scary moment in baseball. The Chicago Cubs, the Houston Astros, and that foul ball rocket from Cubs center fielder Albert Almora, it hit a little girl on the third baseline. You know, this is at Minute Maid Park. She's taken to the hospital. He collapses, falls to his knees, sobbing.
Yeah.
He said, I want a net around this whole stadium. But we know this has been raised before. The owners say fans don't want the obstructed view. But, you see these hits.
Yeah, well, I would think the owners would say, but we definitely don't want horrific images and realities of little kids getting hit by balls.
Right.
Last year, a woman was struck by a foul ball. She died. In 2017, there was a rash of foul balls hitting fans or even bats breaking and going into stands. And they changed the rules because it's very important not to have these tragedies interfere with what should be an entertainment. So there was a period where these arguments were hashed out. Oh, we don't want too much netting and it will cost us a little bit of money. And on the ticket, it says there's an assumption of risk. But of course, you have two or three or four of these horrible incidents, you're going to try to do whatever you can to mitigate it.
Yeah.
I just don't know. You know, Amora, in the moment, I understand he's upset. A fencing or a net around the entire arena, that seems perhaps an overreaction, but maybe to extend it a little past the dugout, which would have maybe saved the girl.
Yeah. Well, and she's
going, yes. She seems, by all accounts,
okay.
She seems to be recovering.
Okay. Yeah. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.